this is Harry Hawk, and today we are hanging out with Dennis Yu, a Facebook and online marketing expert. This is part of the FIR interview series, and this interview will also appear on talkingabouteverything.com, my own podcast. Dennis, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Harry. Glad to be here.
I'm glad we were able to schedule it, and thank you for making yourself available. I know that you have a long history with online marketing, both at companies as well as at Yahoo, and then later for a couple of other companies now with Blitz Metrics. But what can you tell us about your background? What really is the core of your expertise or interest?
I've been a data geek. I've loved math. I did math before I learned how to speak English at the age of 7. And being Asian, I was one of those kids that liked to blow the curve. And so when the internet came around back in the dial-up days in the mid-90s, I was building bulletin boards and naturally got started building websites, went to American Airlines and built a website there, Yahoo, and then the Facebook stuff happened about 2007. So since then, it's been about applying basic math principles to where there's a lot of nonsense and noise and people who are confused with online marketing, and just turning systems that are vague and very PR and subjective oriented to, and it's kind of like balancing the art and the science to where we can actually drive results. And how do you tie things that are typically in the realm of an artist to make it make sense for a scientist and vice versa? So we like to play in that space. And I've always had a fascination for trying to quantify everything.
Well, quantification is certainly a wonderful skill. And something that we really need for interactive online marketing as we approach the real advent of programmatic and just, you know, large scale buys where we really lose the individual connection to the person that we're, quote, speaking to. Do you find that at this point, Facebook is a primary vehicle for you in terms of online advertising, or are there other sites and methods that you're using?
We see Facebook as the core of the data-driven, ROI-driven side of things, not because we love Facebook or because we think social media is amazing, but Facebook happens to have the largest data platform, at least in the United States, meaning that if you're the utility, right, if you're the electric company, then you have to enable all of the guys that build appliances, refrigerators, dryers, you know, things that plug into the wall that are on top of that electrical grid. So Facebook allows you to connect all of your audiences. And what a lot of people don't know is that you can actually tie in all the people who come in from Google, all the people on the email list, all the people who've been to your site, and have all of that tied together, do analysis on it for nothing, be able to advertise, be able to retarget, tie in programmatic rules, tie in marketing automation. So if you've got rules set up in Infusionsoft and MailChimp, people don't know that that kind of mechanical, as we call it, plumbing, as possible. So we consider that as a first step. And so it's not so much a Facebook first or a Facebook dominant strategy as much as you've got different channels, right? There's different things that you're doing on Instagram, on your blog, on, you know, billboards and radio and TV. You have all these marketing channels. You have all this content. You have all these audiences. And you need something to tie it together so that you give users this personalized CRM one-to-one kind of experience, right? So there's been a lot of talk about that for 20 years on what personalized direct marketing might look like. But with Facebook's platform, and Google is just about as powerful, you can actually stitch those audiences together, ideally dump in your content, and then make sure it gets seen. Of course, the catch in the last couple of years has been you've had to pay, right? And of course, with Google, you've always had to pay to get that extra on top of what's free. And Facebook, people are complaining, you have to pay, but because the math works out, we tend to find that it works better. It doesn't mean that you should have Facebook as your primary vehicle, but certainly we think that's the first place to start. And then once you've got all of your channels working and you've got a common set of goals, a common set of content and common set of audiences tied together, it's very easy to balance your efforts on where you as a business person or a PR person, based on whatever you're measured against, is going to get the highest ROI. More sales, more mentions, more leads, more of whatever's quantifiable.
Well, I'm a big believer in all of that, particularly with the retargeting on Facebook, and even just in the sense of traditional American media. There was a time that you could buy two or three television stations, right? ABC and NBC, or CBS and ABC, and cover 80, 90% of the nation. I think, you know, that play today is Facebook.
Facebook is the new TV, right? And we were just at Facebook's headquarters last week for a series of meetings, and we were remarking about how video was so powerful. And not only do you have the benefits of being able to reach and engage people, but because it's through mobile, you've got multi-device consumption occurring where people, they might be watching Netflix and they've got their phone, or they're sitting in front of their big screen plasma TV and they have their laptop or iPad. So you've got all these tied together, and the size of the audiences and the ability to target has made it such that, I guess different people have different stats, but the audiences appear to be about the same size on Facebook as they do on TV, depending on how you count fractional attention. Yet the TV spend is 5 to 6 times bigger than in social, also depending on how you count that. So there's huge opportunities to shift budget with relative attention and audience sizes.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you look at people using television, the way it's been falling off, that I think we've got a larger audience on Facebook, you know, particularly if you're skewing over 25, I would say. But yeah. I think it's a fantastically affordable platform. My question is, obviously, because this is the elephant, and I have been saying that a lot of people project into Facebook. They make a whole bunch of claims that Facebook is changing their algorithm, changing their business practice to ensure that they make money. And obviously, they're in business to make money. But I'm trying to say this nice in terms of the people who claim that, you know, the only way to get seen on Facebook is to pay. The sites, a lot of the sites that I run or work with are still seeing tremendous organic reach. And I think that for me personally, the changes that Facebook has made better content more attractive than it used to be, not less attractive. You have any thoughts there?
So there's many ways to attack that angle. I think the easiest way to say it is that sales is often viewed as, you know, buy my stuff, self-promotional, gimme, gimme, look here, you know, yell louder. And marketing is viewed as, hey, how do I think about the customer and what do they want and how do I serve them in an open, collaborative kind of way? Because the amount of information that's available is increasing at an order of magnitude faster than our ability to consume it, that creates more pressure on any algorithm to filter. So the filtered power get stronger and stronger. So rather than get mad at the algorithm or pretend that there's some kind of disingenuous, oh, they just want to force us to, you know, they're turning us down because now they're trying to make us pay for it. I don't think that's the case. We do Facebook marketing for the Golden State Warriors. And one of the last videos that we posted had 2 million views and 6,000 impressions and who knows, 50,000 likes. Of course, it's, you know, the NBA, the number one team in the NBA. Of course, people are going to share that content. But that's just proof that the algorithm actually determines what's working and what's not working. And you don't have to be in media and entertainment. You can be a small biz. We know of some restaurants, for example, that will post pictures, like La Gondola in Chicago. They'll post a picture of the pizza special or the lasagna special tonight. And that thing, even if they're not boosting it, will get tons of attention. So there's no, you can't poo-poo the necessity to have quality content, because if you get sharing and liking and commenting and what have you in the first 60 seconds, or some people say 2 minutes of when you post something on Facebook, Facebook continues to give you additional reach. If you're out there self-promotional and it's all about you and buy my stuff, of course, Facebook's going to penalize you in the newsfeed, and it's not because they're trying to force you to advertise. So I never think of the paid stuff on Facebook as advertising. I view it as ensuring that you get additional distribution because you care. You know, saying advertising implies that person, you don't really care about them. You just want their money, right?
Absolutely. I work with a bakery, small bakery neighborhood, 7,000 fans on Facebook. You know, we did a post the other day, got 4,000 impressions. Not only do I see that the algorithm changes have really helped people who have really great content, I think on some level, intuitively, and again, asking for your insight because you do a lot more of this than I do, I really think they're taking your audience, the people who like your fan page, and they're segmenting it. And the algorithm isn't just deciding if content's good or not, but I get the feeling, again, it's strictly subjective, that they're based on who's responding and how fast they're responding and all of that, that they're segmenting it and showing it to those people within your publics who would most want that content.
Yeah. So definitely there's been an alignment between people who engage with the page. You're more likely to show information related to that page. And certainly if your friends are engaging, that certainly adds weighting to where you might more likely see that content. But to your point, let's say that you're a fan of the Los Angeles Times and you really like sports information, and maybe I like politics information. If I continue to consume and interact with political information, then the algorithm is going to show me, and not a person, it's the algorithm. You don't want to personalize it by, you know, saying yes, a person is trying to twist us. But Facebook notices what type of content. So it certainly makes sense that if you create different content streams, Facebook's going to be able to figure out which of these personas are going to match up, right? So if you've got a strong content strategy, Facebook will do this automatic segmentation. So for those people that do advertising, there's an algorithm they use, which is the default. It's called Optimize CPM, where you select a business objective, conversions, event registration, video views, whatever, and they will find which content's going to work the best. So the other side of the content, or deeper set of content, is product information. So Facebook, you've probably seen the multi-product ads have come out, where you can actually put multiple items that, you know, people who like this also like that, you know, like Amazon or Netflix, people who watch this, they also watch that. Well, the multi-product ads, which you've seen with three or four different units inside the same space, is moving into dynamic product ads, right? The idea of a dynamic product ad is they're already figuring, you upload your catalog and all the different items that you sell. And it doesn't have to be e-commerce. It can be anything. It can be lead gen. It can be different stories, products, landing pages, webinars. It can be anything you have, not just SKU-driven kinds of things in a catalog. But you upload these items, and Facebook will start to determine, gee, I see, Harry really likes this piece of content. He might really like that piece of content. So can you imagine, like, the kinds of crazy gymnastics people do inside their marketing automation system? So if you have like an Infusionsoft or a Marketo or one of some crazy content management system, and you're trying to associate these rules in a crazy flowchart kind of way, Facebook and some other guys in this space are trying to simplify it to learn for you, so you don't have a series of static rules. And that's where you think of how the newsfeed is trying to figure out, of all the stuff you could consume, right? And it's like 95% yep, plus being filtered out. How do we also do it on the ad side? How do you also do it in terms of recommendations? Like, if you like this movie, you like that movie. Have you noticed, like, you consume a news article on Facebook, and then below it, it'll say, hey, here's three other news articles, yes, or here's three other videos that are like this?
Yeah, it's getting very good and very accurate.
Yeah, so they're giving you more of what you want. You really like chocolate ice cream, they're going to give you more chocolate ice cream. And now there's this whole debate around should Facebook be doing this, or should, which is causing some people to form grotesque profiles, because if you like A, you become more and more of A, right? It creates these yep, spike profiles where people become super, super niched out based on, you know, anything you have gets multiplied out, to where, you know, some folks are saying, well, we need to have a general education, or Facebook, or it's like a net neutrality for the newsfeed. Like, we need to show a little bit of everything, or it's like a discrimination kind, you know, like different kinds of content can't be discriminated against. I don't know. It's starting to feel that way, where you have these different camps. So it's like laissez-faire, right? Or the government needs to come in and control this thing.
Well, I think it's going to be very clear, is if you're spending less time with Facebook, then they're going to have a lot more control over what you're seeing in the newsfeed. And if you're spending hours and hours a day, they're going to find the room to show you a lot of things. And, well, it's in their interest to show you what you seem to be most interested in, or what will get you going, even if that's a cat pic. I know some people who have some private chat areas on Facebook. We're talking some, you know, really deep economic or scientific kind of discussions, where in a day or two, you're seeing 100 or 200 replies to a post. Each reply is one or two or more paragraphs in depth. So I know I've personally seen just, you know, there's still absolutely tremendous interaction on Facebook, but it's not necessarily, you know, branded.
You know, it's funny, because people talk about Facebook as a monolith, but if you look at the top six apps out there, four of them are Facebook, because there's Facebook as the platform, Instagram, there's
Messenger.
There's Messenger. Yeah, I mean, so you've got a federated environment, an archipelago like all the Greek islands, right? Or all the cities within LA that are trying to pretend like they're LA, instead of a monolith. And the reason why they've moved to that strategy is because they have to capture attention. And to your point, if they're not taking care of the users and providing a great experience, they're not going to capture the data or the attention. If you don't have the data, you can't serve relevant ads, because you need enough data to personalize, to know what you like, to know what you're doing, and all that. So if Facebook wanted to juice their next quarter's earnings, sure, they could just jam ads and allow brands to have all the things that they want, which actually is at the expense of the users. But if they always hold the users first, which is what they've been saying all along, and it sounds kind of like the Google don't be evil sort of thing, but it actually is true economically, and I see why they've done that, and I've met with Zuckerberg, and he has told me as such, and I believe him, that they have been doing this to put the user first, because in the long run, if their goal is economic and to make as much money as they can on advertising, they have to build up the largest user base, not just in a MySpace, have as many friends as possible sort of way, but the depth of a recurring, you know, daily active user base that's continuing to interact and log in, check their mail, buy their stuff, right? So that's why the payments platform, the integrations with Messenger, the VR stuff with Oculus, I can imagine, you know, the tie-in with the self-driving cars and ads that are showing on the iPads and all that. All of that is to capture the attention, because whoever owns the attention owns the wallet. And I think that's where Facebook's long-term strategy is. It's not about brands complaining, oh, my stuff's not showing up in the newsfeed anymore, and then now they've tricked me because they want me to advertise. I think Facebook is way beyond that. And so people who complain are not realizing that they don't care about the user. That's the problem.
Right. And they're used to this traditional marketing of, you know, got to run 6 or 7 ads on television to break through. You need 5 or 6 postcards to break through. So, you know, they're standing on a street corner spinning their sign, and the users don't like that. And if you want to be angry at someone, be angry at people for being human and not wanting to constantly get the same marketing message, when in fact we could be inspiring people, we could be reaching out. And so it is absolutely my belief, and I'll get your check in on this thought, but it's absolutely my belief that when we look at traditional sales, marketing, and PR/communications, it's the PR team that has actually won the war, that their sets of skills are the one that we need, you know, actual quality messages that people can relate to, that messages that people want to read. That's what is the magic that you need for Facebook.
You bring up a fantastic point. So for the PR people, there, I view there as being two main camps. So there are the super traditional PR, hey, you know, for immediate release, we launched this new product. Hey, you know, there's this amazing thing that you need to care about that's all about us, right? There's that kind of blast thing. And then there's the more sophisticated, elegant, eloquent way of really providing value to the journalists. So I write for Adweek. So I get hit all the time on guys that want their stuff being covered. Hey, you should write an article about how we have this new thing. Like, why should we do that? Because it's really important to us. Okay, why is it important to our audience? Right? You know what I'm right. talking about. You know, you don't want to be like that guy in the street corner where it's all, where the idea of marketing is like conquesting customers, their targets to be hit instead of their relationships. And PR, I think, is evolved
in blasting. It's Tom Cruise in that P.T. Anderson movie, I think Magnolia, yeah. You know, seduce and destroy. Was his mantra, you know, and he was teaching all the guys to seduce and destroy women. Okay, it was a crazy movie, but that's what a lot of these marketers, they just want to have their way to their bottom line, but aren't. I have my own little theory that I've been talking about on FIR for a while. I call it entanglement. It's based on the research I did at NYU back in the early 90s, but it comes from the idea of quantum mechanics that, you know, entanglement on the quantum level. I talk about marketing entanglement, that long-term relationship between brands and consumers that survive time and distance. And what we really want is to establish that entanglement and to maintain it. And as long as we are being respectful, interesting, listening, helpful to the consumers, they will remain entangled with us. And then when there is a time for them to buy a product or look to spend some money, we have a better chance of being top of mind than constantly running 29 ads a day and yeah. hoping that someone will see them.
And that's exactly it, because you would have the same ethical standards as you would with your friends, right? On what's polite and not polite. You wouldn't shill like that among your friends if you're having dinner. So we think about PR as often being shilling, where you're trying, it's like lobbying in a way. But the really smart PR people know it's about developing those key relationships. But the technology guys have said, well, it's all about the software and social media and magical algorithms. And, you know, I specialize in that space, right? All that math and voodoo. And so in the same way that on the PR side, you have the people that are like, those people.
Yeah.
On the other side, on the marketing side, you have the tech weenies who believe that it's only their world too. It's like this, you know, Mac versus PC sort of world. And neither of them is correct, because the PR folks understand that it's about finding that unique angle, right?
Yeah.
Not about manipulating, but something that's truly interesting. Like, oh, that's so cool. I think the New York Times would really actually want to share that, right? That's really cool. That's neat. And so it's helpful. And so no amount of technology will overcome the need to be strategic and have cool things to say. But just because you're strategic doesn't guarantee you're going to have the reach, and you're going to be able to prove the ROI, and you'll be able to micro-target and deal with the social networks. So there's a new breed of PR person that's coming through that understands a little bit of both, where they're not necessarily a tool jockey, but they understand brand strategy. They understand relationships and nurturing people over time instead of like, buy my stuff right now. And I think that's the oil and water kind of mix that's very hard to come by, but that's the new breed of marketer, the cross-channel marketer that's coming through now. And that means the PR person has to understand marketing automation and understand advertising too.
Right.
Advertising for like the Facebook micro-targeted advertising. And that's we have this thing we call the dollar a day strategy,
yeah,
Harry. And that is anytime you have a press release or something interesting, some kind of piece of content. It doesn't have to be even a press release. It's just like, oh, we got cited in someplace, or we have a new blog post, or the CEO posted a picture of his breakfast. It doesn't matter. Some piece of content. You can target the people who work in the industry, right?
Yeah.
People who work at the Wall Street Journal, people who work at TechCrunch, people who work at the conference that you'd otherwise go to, who work at your top customers, because you import that list and tie them together. And so the whole point of micro amplification is, if you target by where they work and target by their job title, not the fact that they like the New York Times, but that they work at the New York Times, or that they're a staff journalist, or that they are like a pediatrician, or like whatever it is that you're trying to do, right?
Yeah.
The dollar a day strategy, when you're targeting audiences of just a couple hundred people, if you have a dollar a day, you can hit 200 people. Like super, super finely targeted. So I consider that to be the ultimate PR. You're spending a buck a day, but it's not advertising. You just happen to pay, if you've got a good message, to hit the audience that you want.
Well, I think that's brilliant. I'm a huge believer on and offline with micro-targeting. I got a computer story I'll tell you someday, but a company I work for ran ads, but only in Las Vegas during CES, only in a couple hotels, and they made the world think that something interesting was happening. But I have been encouraging the communications people, as part of their crisis planning, to have retargeting set up on their site, even if they, you know, cashes out after 6 months, I believe, but you set up retargeting on different parts of the site. And if on your crisis planning, if you're creating a new post or a new section of the site to deal with the crisis, to enable retargeting as well, I believe that there's this opportunity. Something happens, something's gone wrong. People start coming to your website, and based on the pattern of where they're going and how often they're coming and all of the kinds of analysis that you can do, you may want to reach those people later. And this gets back to my entanglement. You have no way of knowing who in that first 24 hours came to our website, except, retargeting does.
Yeah. And you build up that audience as an insurance policy, because the last thing you want to do is be in trouble and, we have to try to figure out something, right? You know, the best defense is a good offense. And when you have strong retargeting, it's like you already have a list, in the same way you have an email list or a contact list. You've got a list of all the people who have been to your site, who have, you know, been a fan on Facebook, who have commented, all that kind of stuff. And then you're able to exert influence because you've pre-built those audiences, not just on Facebook, but you build them on Google. So anyone here who's doing retargeting, you would want to run native retargeting on Google, Facebook, and Twitter at the same time. So you build up those audiences. And those audiences cross over into mobile too. So they're on their phone, you can reach them there.
And just like you were talking about the micro-targeting, some journalists or stuff, I've also talked about micro-targeting of stakeholders. And again, I don't get a lot of people really seeing that, but it's like, again, in a crisis or any kind of environment where you have a couple of folks, it could be literally 100 regulators or community board members, it could be members of the board, it could be their families, it could be really just some very particularly important stakeholders that you want to make sure that when they're coming on Facebook or wherever they are. You mentioned Google and Twitter as well, that you're getting in front of them.
Yeah. So if you got a pitch, let's say you're an agency and you got a pitch with Starbucks because you saw some problems that they had with that race initiative. Or let's say maybe you're going there to visit and you want to close the deal. Well, you would get your latest authoritative content, not pitchy content, but stuff that really shows that you're high power because it's a third party, right, review, some article that's written up or a presentation that you gave. And then you target that to people who work at Starbucks that are in Seattle that work in marketing. And that might be something like 120 people. And that would cost you 50 cents a day, right, for as long as you want to run that group of articles against those people. That's micro influence. That's if you had... Right? We like to say, Harry, if you had a million minions and they could call up as many people as you wanted, no cost, how would you do that? That's the way we think about that.
I just did an interview with the president of the University of Cincinnati, Dr. Ono, and I'm running some targeted Twitter ads just in a couple cities in Ohio around where the university is. I certainly think it's an interesting approach.
My friend, his Toyota, he got a bad experience at the dealer. So he targeted all the people who work at Toyota in management in Tokyo, right? Spent a dollar a day, and he got a call a couple days later from the GM saying, sorry, hey, stop whatever you're doing. I'm getting calls from all these other people in Japan and executives. And so it works. Like I think I told Shell and J.D. Lesko about this. We met and we did one of those social media breakfasts about how powerful it is in terms of consumers that are able to fight back because they can do this sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
And companies can use it the same way. PR people can use it. That's the amazing weapon. It's an equalizer. And if you micro-target really well, then a dollar a day is more than enough. But PR people usually don't get control over the ad budgets because it's another function or it's seen as encroaching. But that's what we like.
Well, Dennis, I'm thinking normally I'd kind of cut off the interview right here and maybe go into overtime. But it seems like we should just keep on talking if that's all right with you.
Yeah, let's do it.
So what do you want to talk about? We could go down the rabbit hole of micro-targeting and local businesses. We could talk about how to redesign the PR industry from the bottom up or how to integrate marketing and sales and communications. What is there a particular rabbit hole you like?
Let's talk about who killed the agency because these agencies are getting disrupted and they don't know what to do. They pretend and represent that they know how technology is changing, but they're having trouble adapting. Clients are taking the stuff in-house. The networks, whether it's the TV networks or Google or Facebook or whatever, they're trying to take it directly to the consumer. So everyone's trying to cut the agency out. And the PR people are now starting to sound kind of like the SEO people, where they all kind of sound the same. And it's hard to really create value. And I guess you have some clients that if you really wine and dine them, they're not going to change, or you're in regulated industries where, you can wait a little while, but it's not the elephant in the room that the PR folks are getting disrupted and they need to figure out some way to be faster and be more measurable in their efforts with what they're doing with the clients, even though they don't have necessarily the expertise in each of the client verticals, right? And they definitely don't know what to do with social media or mobile or anything that appears tech-oriented, right?
I think right now the latest surveys that Shell and Neville were talking about shows that there's really a lack of social hands-on experience in the C-suite at the top level. Again, I think they've won if they would only let themselves do what they do, which is create this amazing content, but not have an adverse reaction to putting some dollars behind it or using some technical safety pins to keep it focused and targeted.
A lot of the folks that we see, especially the boutique PR folks, they're industry focused or they're focused in doing like event coverage or producing, certain kinds of creative formats. We think that for PR agencies to be more effective and more powerful, at least as it relates to social, they have to follow certain checklists that tie to personal branding sequences. So what that means is that the client, if you're really good at PR, then you're basically invisible in terms of you're behind the scenes and you lift up the client. They look so good that you're the magician behind the curtain, right? Don't look behind the curtain. I'm just the Wizard of Oz, right? That kind of thing.
Right, right? Exactly.
So if you're able to be that person who's just supporting them, making them look good, taking their content, if you've got processes that do this in social to gather all the good things that are occurring, to automatically amplify them, to have an army of a million minions, some of which are, using the ad platforms through Google and Facebook and programmatic buying, that kind of stuff, then you're able to indisputably prove value to the customer. And without having to charge a lot of extra money, without having to buy a bunch of tools, without having to hire consultants or sub the work, right? The bigger the agencies are, the more likely they're going to sub the work. But then, you know, the client knows that's the case. The client knows that you might be hiring a bunch of kids and marking it up. That's what agencies do. That's kind of tried and true. You know, that's accepted. So how do you get around that? Because then if the client knows you're doing that, they're just going to take it away and do it themselves, right? And save the markup. Unless they're just too busy, they'd rather write a bigger paycheck. So we think that the answer is that you have to beat the customer to the punch on this, right? So what the client, the ideal marketer for a client, think about it, is the customer, right? So if you're a PR agency, you might have however many clients you have. There's no way you can be an expert in every single discipline and subject matter that all of your clients are in. It's crazy, right?
Yeah.
Even in niche B2B places, it's super hard to. So what you do is if you have a way of recruiting the best customers for those clients and have a system to source their content and aggregate it in a way that doesn't make it sound like you're stealing it or republishing people's pictures without their rights or anything like that, right? Then you can amplify that. You tie it to their business goals, and then you've created personal branding for the executives that are your clients. You make them look good, right, within the client organization by amplifying the people who work at Starbucks or work at, you know, whatever client organization is or in the industry.
You're talking about not only amplifying the insiders, but also amplifying the end customer, or is it
you're
just
amplifying everything? Yeah, you've got a bunch of micro targets. So think of whoever, you know, you got Sally and she's the VP of marketing at some company and she hired you, you're the PR firm. Well, you're going to make Sally look good among her peers, among other people in the company, right? Because she got an interview somewhere, you're going to amplify that. But you're going to amplify the top customers as well, because when you give them a little bit of love or you quote them, they're actually creating content for you. And a lot of people, they say, this is like a BuzzFeed approach or it's lowbrow. Like, okay, the 10 ways that you can do X, and X is some industry issue that your company's dealing with, right? That's something that actually works, right? It's a great way to create content. It's not just a top 10 list as a strategy to create content, but there's many ways where you create a mechanism to identify the most authoritative, passionate customers of the client and get them to write content that you as the PR agency never could, unless, you know, let's say you work for Jeep and you don't actually drive a Jeep and you don't actually go off-roading and know how to work on cars. How are you going to create authoritative content to the Jeep community? Sorry, you're not, right? You have to source those people and make them look good and then act as a PR agent at scale. And that's where social media gets everyone's panties in the wad. Because they don't understand the process on how do you do that. Because they're used to dealing with just one person, or their pace of iteration and completing projects is so slow and so expensive that they can't micro-target. They can't create the micro-content necessary to feed those micro-targets. So we put together something we call the 30-item checklist, right? Okay. And this 30-item checklist is something that actually college kids have been running through. We've been testing it 3 or 4 colleges across the United States. And we find that college kids can actually implement this. And if you're a PR agency, you probably have some interns or you have, you know, folks who are junior staff, only a couple of years of experience just out of college. And those guys are perfect for implementing this, provided that they are a customer of that underlying client, right? If you find an intersection of the ideal customer, someone who loves that client's products and services, independent of whether they actually work for your agency, and you get them in on internships and what have you, you can source those people, they become the best content marketers. There is no better content marketer than a happy customer.
Yeah.
Right? So if you embrace that part and then you put a process against it to amplify the content that these people produce, segment those pieces of content up into personas that you tie back to goals at different parts of the funnel, right? Entanglement that you're talking about, then you have modeled out the content necessary at every stage of the relationship of the customer segments for that client, because you've found actual people at each of those stages, right? We have a client there, a storage, they have a national storage facility, you know, they have hundreds of locations where you store your stuff, right? They all look the same, right? If you think about it, it's sort of a commodity business and it's not like people really have brand attachment, but you know, when you need to move or you have a baby and you need to put stuff in storage or, you know, whatever. So that's a business that you wouldn't think would work in social media, right? But guess what? They find interesting content by sourcing customer stories It's actually Storage Mart, Storage-Mart. And their head of marketing has spent seven figures on Facebook ads. Initially not as smart, and now a lot smarter because of the content production and sequencing down into these different segments. And that's the kind of model that will work at scale and at low cost, which is kind of like having your cake and eat it too. And I think the PR people are uniquely positioned to make this happen because they naturally understand story. They understand, you know, what kind of things are going to get attention, but they might not understand the technology. And then there's technology folks, software people like me, that think it's all about, well, I'll just, you know, create enough robots and then somehow magically the algorithm will fix everything. But that's not ever the case either, right? The 20-year-old Silicon Valley person is not gonna understand the nuances of some sort of B2B niche, right? Whatever niches we plan. They're not. They're building software and they're 23 years old, right?
Right. Well, I think there's also room in here for event marketing and stuff where you bring a bunch of customers together and create something that's very real and tangible for them, and then chunk that all out and it's all very authentic, and you know, that becomes 2 or 3 months, maybe a year's worth of content for you.
Recycle the content, just like your turkey leftovers. Everything is a content marketing opportunity, right? Anytime you, like our little podcast here, we'll turn this into multiple articles, right? Anytime you have an event and you're interviewing customers or people are speaking, those are all, right? You video people, the video turns into a podcast, the podcast turns into a blog post, the blog post gets, you get comments from other people in the industry. Now you've got multiple blog posts that are based on that. That's how you overcome the whole, I can't create enough content. I don't have a big enough content team. I don't have enough resources. I don't have the ad budget. If you've got processes for the content marketing and you've got processes to share for anyone here on the podcast, right? Then these are things that you can follow. And then you pull in the customers of the client. You pull in folks who are junior on your staff and they can implement this.
All right. Let's get down to a couple real technical details on the retargeting and stuff, because I think maybe there's a lot of people who've never really looked at it. They understand the very core mechanism, which is when somebody's visited your website, you have an opportunity to give them a message later. But they don't understand all of the psychographic and geographic and all the other kinds of filters that Facebook gives you, and that you can obviously additionally target people by email or phone number. But what are you, if you had to give somebody a rundown, sort of a, not a 1,000-foot view, but a, you know, a 30-foot view of ad targeting within Facebook, can you just give people a rundown from your point of view? What are some of the more interesting, you know, features and widgets that you can, you know, use to finely tune your ad deployment?
So I'm going to start with some things that are more basic, and then I'm going to go geeky on you, okay? So at some point, perfect, I might lose some people. The whole point of retargeting is you've identified who that user is. I don't care if you've identified them because you have their email, or you're cookied them by dropping the pixel, or they're using your app, or they're a fan on the page. Whatever it is, you've identified somebody, right? They come to a certain page and they didn't buy. They went to the shopping cart and they did something or they didn't, or whatever it is, right? They're in an audience bucket. So when you're in the audience manager in Facebook, which you should be running through business.facebook.com, most people aren't doing that, shame on you, then you're able to figure out where the intersections are between these different audiences and therefore associate a sequence of experiences that you're going to deliver. So for example, the easiest, the most common example, the shopping cart abandonment. They came to your site, they put something in the basket, but they didn't put their credit card in and check out. So then you send them a series of messages saying, hey, come back. And then later you say, wait, 20% off if you check out in the next, you know, whatever it is you say is a sequence of messages, right? So if you've got the logic that ties together what content you deliver to what audiences, then you really are doing the same thing you would be doing in email marketing, right? Because you're segmenting the list and you're triggering messages based on something that has happened or has not happened after a certain amount of time. So if you're setting up your audiences properly on Facebook, I don't care if it's a custom audience that includes a website custom audience or an email audience, either way, it's an audience.
Let's think about a kind of a real traditional PR communications kind of objective. New product launch, new store opening. Maybe it will help make it more relevant to folks listening.
Provided you've done a good job already to bring people in, because, you know, garbage in, garbage out. So, yeah, you know, you've got a store opening, new product, you know, somebody got promoted, you have a new CEO, whatever. Then assuming that the people you have brought to the site are the right people and you've done a good job, we're going to follow those same people around everywhere. So when that pixel fires, and you're going to have the Google remarketing pixel fire at the same time, then Facebook says, oh, hey, I have this person. It's Harry Hawk, and his user ID is 12345. And I also happen to know that that is Harry Hawk on this iPhone and on this iPad and on this laptop. And, oh, he logged in over at the public library. Here he is again. So now, even if you log into some other device that we've never seen before, where we've never cookied you, because it's based on the Facebook login, then we persist in our ability to target against you. So this is how you target in the mobile. Facebook has something called FAN, which is Facebook Audience Network. It's Facebook's version of AdSense, basically, right? And now we can target across all the third-party apps that are in the Facebook network. Twitter is launching the Twitter Audience Network, I think, later this summer. And Google has their version, which, you know, whatever. You think about, you know, AdMob and MoPub as part of Facebook. These are all networks which are AdSense-like because third-party publishers, these are app owners too, right? It's not just websites, but we're talking about the entire digital landscape, are putting in ad tags from Facebook and, you know, of course, with Twitter and other guys so that they can serve ads that come from you triggered by the sequence logic that you determine. So when they're, you know, so-and-so is now promoted to the senior vice president of such, I don't know, whatever the thing is that you want to promote and you have them tagged, then you can intersect that with the audience of your customers. You can intersect it with people who are in the media. You can intersect it with the friends of fans of Harry Hawk and people who yep. work at Ketchum and at the, you know, PR Week and Media Post and all that, right? You can, because all that stuff is connected down to Facebook, your audiences, your retargeting audiences are connected and intersected with all these. So now you can filter by their age and where they are. Like, you wouldn't have that on your website, but because it was connected back through Facebook's big data platform, this utility that we were talking about, this giant data infrastructure, we can tie disparate data sources. So email data, purchased point of sale data, if you have a loyalty card, frequent flyer mileage, you know, that kind of stuff. I can tie all that stuff together with the fact that you've been to the website, right? Very creepy, like precog, you know, Minority Report, Tom Cruise kind of stuff, right? But yep. that's available right now. And we think that PR folks need to be doing that. And it goes back to what we talked about for the dollar a day, right? The dollar a day strategy is when you micro target five or six different audiences, each one you're putting a buck against it, you might be spending $5 a day, $10 a day, right? But now it doesn't matter where they're coming from. If you have some piece of content you want to get out to a certain audience, you could even show it to people who read whatever the industry vertical is, because that's where you're trying to, you know, call people up or email people all day long trying to get them to cover your story. But you do it this way, and then you intersect it, or you say minus people who've already seen it, or plus people who are already customers, so you can really start to segment who sees messages when. That's what we're talking about. You've got to create in your mind, and eventually on paper, this big flow chart of who needs to see what when, and then your Facebook and Google strategy really takes form.
And I also use it, by the way, Dennis, very locally. One of my clients is a local bakery, been around since the early 60s. They had closed, and my client took them, reopened them. And so that immediate neighborhood in New York is about 60, 70,000 people in that zip code. That's honestly the only people who really are going to be going there regularly. But then when you include a couple extra zip codes around there, you're looking at maybe about 500,000 people who may come for the holidays and stuff. For the major holidays in a 3 or 4 week period, we'll spend $500 to $1,000 with maybe a 25, 30 cent per thousand price at the end, you know, blended cost. And we're literally targeting everybody in the zip code, a frequency anywhere from 6 to 10 times. We bifurcate, we put typically about half the money into that immediate zip code and half the money into that larger pool. You know, the content, it's a bakery, it's food, it's pictures of food, it's new food stuff. And, yeah. You know, we see 3 or 4 times what we spend coming back in increased sales.
And local's fantastic. That's where you're going to see all the next changes coming over the next year, you know, mobile, social, local. So for the bakery in one of the, you know, whichever of the New York, you know, burbs that you have, the idea of the local awareness ads where you're going to tie to Facebook payments, this will, if you're a PR person and you're dealing with someone who operates only in a certain city, or like you said, one zip code, this thing is going to be fantastic because you're going to be able to tie it to the point of sale eventually. You're going to be able to tie it to offers. So Facebook's launching a new offers product soon. That, and you may have seen Facebook's offer product, which they still have. You should, if you're doing anything in local and PR, you definitely can because it shows you trackability, especially if there's a code associated with it. The whole point of retargeting is that you just want to follow. If you bring people in, like let's say it could be the bakery, whatever it is, like not, you don't even have to have a sophisticated email marketing program, right? You're just trying to drive awareness. If you drive them to the site or you drive them to, you know, in-store or to the app into one of these audiences, right? The minute they come to the site or they join the list or they become a fan of the page, they've effectively joined a list. And that's when remarketing sequences take effect. So the easiest way to think about it is from a PR standpoint, the way you think of Facebook is there's the two-step sequence, right? You're trying to drive awareness and drive them to come to your site or drive, you know, so you can pixel them or, you know, get their email. And then from there, you have sequences that drive a conversion saying, oh, well, on Monday, you know, we have donuts for sale or whatever it might be, right? Because only once they hit an audience that triggers, you know, where they're a member of a list, do you want to start to deliver things like that, right? You see what I'm saying? A lot of folks in PR, they just treat it as one step from complete unawareness straight to conversion or whatever it is, right? And we think that you have sequences that get people into your list, and then you have a different content sequences for people who have already signed up and who are familiar. There might not be customers yet, but there's a conversion sequence. And so PR folks, as they start to think more about direct marketing and you have relationship nurturing that occurs over multiple steps, then they become smarter marketers and you have entanglement where it's like the dating cycle, you know, first date, kiss, you know, go out and eventually married, right? There's multiple steps in the courtship process. And so you want to set up the same thing. Initially, you have a two-step process. You drive them into custom audiences of different forms of retargeting, and then from that into being customers. And then you show that to the client saying, not only did I get this many press mentions, not only, you know, this many citations or this many impressions, but actually I was able to build this much of an audience. And not just like I have more fans, but you can show the value of that audience because it's you can show honest. It all the way through to a conversion.
I've come out with a new donut flavor and not told anybody except my friends on Facebook, so to speak, and sold 50 to 100 donuts in a day. For a neighborhood bakery, that's real serious numbers for someone who had no prior awareness. But it's definitely a multi-step process, and it's definitely, to me, so important that over time, that entanglement, that you're building a increasingly more important, more relatable, more valued community around your brand. Dennis, I don't have a lot more time today, but this has been absolutely fascinating. If to ask you to sort of conclude and pull all of these threads that we've been talking about together, how would you do that? How would you leave us today?
All of this, if for the folks who have bravely endured to the end, probably creates a lot of confusion and headache and mind exploding sorts of things. Here's the way to simplify it. You need checklists to be able to execute lots and lots of little details and not make it a mess or have stuff that doesn't get done. So you need a checklist for how you manage your content. We call that the personal brand and content management sequence, right? There's a checklist on how to do that. There's a checklist on how you set up your brand's remarketing and amplification efforts on Facebook. We call that the 30-item setup checklist. There's a checklist on how you amplify things where you have a press release or you have a new product or whatever it is that you want to get the news out. That's what we call the Facebook dollar a day checklist, right? And there's checklists for all these other things, but I think these three checklists are the ones that are the most important. And provided that each of us understands conceptually how this works, we can have someone else handle it tactically, like a student. Or for those that have extra time, and last I checked, none of us have any more time, then we might play the first time and then hand it off to somebody else. So at least we know how it works before we manage someone else doing it. But we've made all these checklists available on blitzmetrics.com. And there's no catch. It's all for free. You know, we didn't really talk about our company's mission, but it's to create jobs for young people because we believe young people are the ones that are going to implement the checklists. So this is creating jobs in partnership with the schools we work with to do this. And we demonstrate firsthand how these checklists work because we publish openly with clients that love to share. And so we make just enough money in the sales of these packages to be able to fund the education that we have to bring students through these checklists so they get certified. At the same time, the businesses are able to get ROI. And if they want to hire the students out of our program, great. If they want to bring in kids that they know that are bright, unemployed, but working at McDonald's and pay them directly, but just give them our content, you can do that as well. Or if you're an agency person and you just want to do it yourself and whatever, download all our guides and knock yourself out, right? So we just want to freely disseminate this information. The summary is that these checklists change over time. Facebook changes. You got to change your checklists. But what never changes is the content story. What never changes is the need to collect these different audiences and to nurture them over time, whether it's through Facebook or you know, Google or Marketo or whatever, you know, MailChimp, whatever the favorite tool is. You still have to collect that kind of logic. This logic that you need to build, we think the PR needs to own this, is independent of social networks or whatever tools come and go.
Fantastic, Dennis. I've got a lot of hospitality students who are very interested in doing work related to restaurants and hotels. So give me a call if you need those kinds of students. I want to once again thank you for being part of this FIR interview. And this will also be an interview on talkingabouteverything.com. Dennis, just please let everybody know where to find you on the internet, whatever websites you need to mention and all of that.
Harry, thanks so much for having me. I'm Dennis at blitzmetrics.com. And you can find me on Twitter at Dennis U, DennisYu. And if you send me an email, I always reply. It might take me a couple days. And that's just Dennis at blitzmetrics.com.
Well, thanks again. This is Harry Hawk saying bye-bye. If you've listened this far, send us a message on Twitter or something. Let us know if you've enjoyed this. And this is Harry saying, I hope you have a great week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an FIR Interviews podcast. FIR Interviews is one of the four immediate release series of business podcasts presented by Neville Hobson and Shel Holtz. The anchor podcast in the series is the Hobson and Holtz Report, presented on Monday since January 2005. For information about FIR, to see show notes for the podcasts, and to subscribe to any of the podcasts, visit www.forimmediaterelease.biz. You can also subscribe via iTunes and other podcast directories. If you have any comments about this podcast or would like to suggest other topics for future podcasts, please email us at fircomments@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.